Good afternoon. Welcome once again to this week's What Comes Next Live, coming to you live and direct at 5 p.m. UK time, and it's 12 midday in Rochester, New York, where this week I am extremely happy to be joined by my friend Bruce Peters, who is surrounded by his five grandchildren in the lovely artwork behind us. Bruce and I were introduced several years ago by another friend of the show, Mark Rowland, around the idea of self-managed or TEAL organizations. And we have not yet met in person, although we did plan it before the pandemic. It just didn't happen. But we, every time we talk, I learn so much from Bruce's incredibly well-read sage wisdom. And so one of the reasons I do these shows is quite selfish, so I can spend time talking to people I find interesting. But the other another reason is so people can see inside some of these cool conversations. So I have no idea what we'll talk about. Normally the theme is around what comes next, around leadership, around what's going on in the world, what's next for the individual. But I've not spoken with Bruce for about a month, but often we can go longer. But we always get going straight away with something. So on this midday on a Tuesday, what's on your mind, Bruce? And welcome, by the way.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. And what's on my mind is a really great question. When we set this up, Tom, I thought you know me, you know, reasonably well, and we've been chatting a lot. I'm much better responding to a problem or an issue than I am kind of talking extemporaneously. And so kind of where to start the conversation with if we had an issue with things. But one of the things that struck me, and you and I have kind of gone back and forth on this a little bit, is what comes next is just been terribly annoying to me. Because I keep thinking about and just kind of circling in the background of my thinking is it's not what comes next. What comes next is terribly predictable. Mm-hmm. It's thinking about what happens after what comes next. Is that what we should be addressing? And the pandemic has just revealed so many of the fault lines in all of our systems and our processes and how we show up in the world of work and with each other in so, so many ways. And we're now going through this dance of, do we get to normal? Do we get that, you know, whatever that language is. And I think we have to get beyond that. I think we have to get beyond the thinking about that and, how to do that, the way to do that. I have no idea about that other than I think we need to begin to have those kinds of conversations. I was struck the other day. Einstein talked an awful lot about imagination and how important imagination is. And, in my own community here in Rochester, we have unbelievable successful community in so, so many ways, but we also have the second worst poverty in the country. We have probably the third worst school system in our urban environment in the country. And we keep throwing things up against the wall and trying the old solutions and they are not working. And we created a system that basically requires the result that we've gotten. And yet we keep doing it again and again. And what are we going to do different? So
it's more about that turn of phrase, created a system that requires the result that we've got. It's an interesting turn of phrase.
Well, I'm probably off a little bit by the statistics, but don't hold me to the actual numbers, but these are good enough to think about. So in 1783, in the colonies, mm-hmm. 25% of the population in the colonies were slaves.
Right.
Fast forward 200 plus years later, almost a quarter of our population in the United States of America are living under the poverty line.
Strong thoughts.
That's the system we've designed.
Hmm.
And our solution to poverty is what?
Well, what would
replicating the system that we have designed. Let's get more of that.
Well, and certainly it's, you know, at this high level you're talking about of concept, is that if what we get is the same results, then we've designed a system that requires, it's really yes. strong language, but requires the results we get.
Yes.
In other words, the measure of this, so there's no imagination fundamentally.
Correct.
We're not. So one of the things that you and I talked about before the pandemic, was ideas around Rochester itself. So perhaps you can talk a little bit about Rochester, because there will be parallels in lots of countries of people who watch or listen to this later. But looking at ways to take the assets Rochester has to transform the, let me just say, societal well-being of the city and surrounding area.
Yeah. So before I go into that, just kind of one of the things is reframing the conversation, reframing what we're trying to do. So what would imagination be? Well, is the solution to poverty anti-poverty? Well, what would the absence of poverty look like? We don't think about that. We don't dream about that. That's where imagination takes you. What would it be like here to have poverty be absent?
And what do we mean by poverty?
Yes.
So a lot of my family comes from one of the poorest parts of the UK, which has never been economically sustainable since the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Isle of Lewis and the Western Isles. But when in the history books, you can read about bits of this, and history is always written by the winners, right? Which in this case was capital.
Yes.
So massive depopulation in the Highlands of Scotland and Ireland due to landowners kicking people off the land. You have the potato famine in Ireland, and you have the Highland clearances in Scotland, where tenant farmers were replaced by sheep because they couldn't pay the rent. Now, in Lewis, somehow or other, whether it be by, you know, scraping through, the tenant farmers were always able to pay the rent. So they remained on the land. Very sparsely populated for the area. But whether it was things like selling seaweed or, you know, all kinds of other stuff, made it through. And I spent almost all my holidays, I never lived there, but I spent almost all my holidays there, my grandparents and family. And I found it idyllic, right? The pace, there was a communal living. There was people gathered peat from the moors for fire to keep their houses warm. They would all come together to bring all the sheep off the moors several times a year, what you call the old word fanks. So you'd actually have them together, and people were, so one guy had the equipment and taught himself how to shear sheep, which then became electric, right? But in return for that, other people, there was a barter and trade economy. No money at all. And a very hard life. So if you came from
this is Bitcoin, nouveau Bitcoin.
Well,
1.0.
It's just barter. It's in the days before. So there's no money. And so jobs with suits and ties and offices were always government jobs, you know, subsidies.
Sure.
But yes, what would the absence of poverty look like? Well, it would be that you work really hard and you have a roof over your head and you have food on the table, but you don't have, perhaps it could be your expectations of material things are different. And maybe, you know, to go to a really obvious one, if you said to, like, you know, I know young people in this country that just started their first job out of college. Have a guess how much vacation time they get their first year.
Yeah.
As an American, you'd say 2 weeks.
Yeah.
They get 5 weeks, and one of them is complaining. He says, when I was at university, I got 12 weeks a year off.
Yeah, exactly.
And now I only have five.
And the professor's got 12 weeks a year off.
Right, but they only have 5 weeks. They only have 5 weeks. Whereas one of my sons, who works for the US-centric organization in Cayman, gets 2 weeks vacation for his first 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
That's the point of poverty.
So there's a bunch of things that are happening, right? And so So there's a phrase, another phrase that's kind of been going around, and a mentor of mine used this phrase, and I'm seeing evidence of it everywhere. And he said, most people prefer the problem they have to a solution they don't like.
Okay.
And so if you just looked at poverty here in the States in terms of money, mm-hmm. just money per person.
Yeah.
Poverty's been reduced here in the States by 50% in the last 6 months.
Okay. Because of government
tax credit, all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden we've eliminated poverty. So what does that tell us about poverty? Well, they're talking about getting rid of that because it actually solved the problem, right? So, or solved a part of the problem that most people associate with poverty. So what's the solution? I'm guessing you could take a bunch of fourth or fifth grade students and you put this problem down of how to reduce poverty in our society and gave them a blank slate and had them do the solution. They could come up with solutions that you and I wouldn't come up with in a million years. And
you know what this has been done? Do you know what they come up with?
I'm sure they have a better answer than we have.
They go, give everybody enough money.
Yes.
To take them above the poverty line.
Yeah.
It's called, and in the grown-up world, it exists. And we know it's a solution, but it doesn't suit our sensibility of you have to work for every penny you make. It's called universal credit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, universal basic income. Sorry, not universal.
Yeah. So,
universal credit is a ghastly social security system they have in the UK.
So one of the other side things that's going on here in the States of impact of COVID, is people are opting out of working.
Hmm.
And there's a tremendous number of people that are just turning down working. So you can go anywhere, particularly people are opting out of the lower level jobs,
mm-hmm.
but the $8, $10, $15 an hour jobs. But there's another whole revolution that's going on at the higher levels of jobs that are actually living wage jobs and more sophisticated kind of jobs. Mm-hmm. And so companies that I know that are labeled as best companies to work for by their employees mm-hmm. forever and ever. A large portion of their workforce are leaving those companies right now.
Hmm.
They're losing some of their best and greatest talent. And this is, at first I noticed it as anecdotal. Now I'm noticing it as more of a trend. What's happened?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that was happening is that underpinning one of the things that got magnified out of COVID, and this is all my freaking opinion about stuff, so hopefully it's grounded in some substance, is that we have a epidemic of loneliness in our country.
Yes. Globally.
And it comes out everywhere. And so some people and some companies were pretty good at recreating community and connection in the companies.
Hmm. Hmm.
Good companies to work for. We're hanging out with the people we like. So they've recreated their neighborhood, their family, their connection, to reduce their loneliness in their work.
Mm-hmm.
And those places were thought to have a great culture.
Right.
COVID comes swooping in and a part of that goes away. The fact that we go to the office and we hang out and we have lunch, we go after and have a drink, we go out and we bike, we walk. All those things were harder and harder to do, and most of them disconnected now from their day-to-day work. So it's a different version. In my companies that I know close and personal, productivity in those companies went sky high. They're all succeeding incredibly well by all metrics. It's now the company...
During the pandemic.
Yeah. Now the company comes back to them and says, okay, let's go to the office. Let's come back to the office. We'll go back to the office. the 18 months, people have reconnected with their family. They've reconnected with their neighborhood. They realize they reconstituted their community. They like the flexibility. My wife and I can do things together. We can, all of these things are now, people who had real jobs and succeeding jobs are deciding to leave those companies and work from home and work for community because their new culture, their new community, their antidote for their loneliness has been recreated and reconstituted in a different way. It's happening everywhere. Example, I have a neighbor down the street who worked for one of these great companies to work for in Rochester. They just took a job making $50,000 more a year for a company that makes a really great, or what's a new, the electric car famous here in the States. That company is moving to Tesla. They hire this person, a technical high-level job. You don't have to move to Austin. You can stay in Rochester. You can stay in your neighborhood. You can work with your family. Your kids don't have to change schools. You just have to come down to Austin 3 or 4 times a year. And by the way, you can make more money staying just where you are.
Could it be two things occur to me. One is when you talked about, you know, it's about asking great questions sometimes. What would the absence of poverty look like? What would the absence of loneliness look like?
Yes.
And two words occur to me, and one around the way you talked about is what people are reconnected to, which is community, and that has so many different meanings. Mm-hmm. The other one is a word which has occurred to me quite strongly around diversity, inclusion, and equity conversations, which is belonging.
Yes.
Outgive somebody at work a feeling of belonging by focusing on diversity, inclusion, and equity initiatives, et cetera, they may feel they belong more. But it's interesting when, I mean, I'm writing a blog for tomorrow's, my daily blog for tomorrow, about perceived benefits of perks.
Yes.
The perks is an abbreviation of perquisite, right?
Yes.
And it's got twisted over time that people don't really know what's a perk and what's a benefit. But generally a perk is a benefit that isn't monetary in nature. And it's interesting if companies may not, and we talk about culture, if companies may not have been aware that one of the benefits they provided to people was a sense of belonging, a sense of community.
Absolutely.
And so they perhaps, you know, the end of my first point is perhaps they, that it's important that companies start to rethink their systems, otherwise they'll keep getting the same results. And right. In fact, they won't get the same results because people don't need it. They find that belonging community somewhere else. The other one is a continuing, thought bubble of mine, which is there will be a lot of people who will stay in the same job. They don't have the freedom of financial choice to do other things, etc. And they might go to work, say, 3 days a week. But there's also the perception among perhaps the people running it. They've got a big house. They can have, like me, I'm privileged enough to have nice computers, ergonomic chair, and a private office, right? A lot of people don't have that. And it's not a perk. It's almost a negative perk to be told you can work from home 2 days a week. Right. So not everybody has that ability. But what if they, you know, I think this, you know, rethinking systems is if a company could say, we are offering you a perk where you can work from home 2 days a week. Some people might go, that's terrible. I'd rather come to the office. Right. A lot of people will go, that's great. So it will vary upon the individual. But what if they then took some of their office budget and used a middleman like an app with a whole bunch of locations and said, here's a third space you can work in your community. So then you get back to the water cooler and the coffee machine conversations, but it's actually with people in your community, not necessarily in your workplace, but it's facilitated and funded by your employer because therefore you're going to be more effective and productive because you've got what you want. So,
yeah. And so it becomes a yes and, right? Rather than an either or. And
absolutely.
So what COVID did is it forced everybody to go do something that they didn't want to do for many people.
Mm-hmm.
And companies were kind of forced to do it. And then once people, you know, people are resilient by and large. And so they made that adjustment. They made the changes. I mean, even in my situation, Tom, I've now had conversations with my neighbors in the last 18 months. I hadn't had a conversation with them for 30 years.
Hmm.
Why? Because we're now communicating. We're looking out for each other. There's a whole bunch of side benefits of that. So by forcing people to have and reconstitute their experience, people were actually able to build their version of that. And then now going back to the office in a more traditional way creates a different change of an experience for them. And I love the idea of fashioning it around loneliness and connection, because it is pandemic. It is truly what's been magnified and multiplied by COVID. You also mentioned DEI, which is kind of interesting to me, but here's a reframing for me. What would the absence of racism be?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. In that particular context. Yeah.
Yeah. What would the absence of that be? And everybody's talking about connection and belonging. There is a place where belonging to a tribe separates you from the rest of humanity. It also reduces your potential empathy. It reduces connection or the possibility of connection in other ways. And so where is the connection supportive? And we probably talked about this. One of my favorite books in the universe is Philip Slater, way back in 1972, wrote a book called The Pursuit of Loneliness. And he said way back then, he predicted, this is post-Vietnam, he said, the unbridled pursuit of independence and freedom at the expense of our interdependencies will be the undoing of democracy in America. In 1972.
Mm-hmm. But the human condition doesn't change, right?
Right. The unbridled pursuit of freedom and independence at the expense of our interdependencies is going to be the undoing of democracy in America. Mm. And it's playing out everywhere. And so the pursuit of loneliness, the connection to my tribe, my thing, although it's got a lot of wonderful ways it can be useful, like anything carried to its fundamental extreme, becomes a thing that connects us, also separates us from others.
Yeah, I mean, I have four tenets of what I call open leadership, right? And on the one hand, they've got to be brave and hungry. On the other hand, it has to be open and humble. So they have to go, I don't have all the answers and I'm curious. Yes. And I believe myself to be somebody who's always had an insatiable curiosity for my fellow man, for mankind, for man, woman, of all, you know, kinds and varieties. So I'm very happy where I've settled in an area of London, which is massively cosmopolitan, right? And people from all kinds of backgrounds just doing their thing and connecting as community.
Yeah.
But if I literally move 5 miles south, I'm in an area where people have been there for four generations and they all look the same.
Yeah.
So they've got their tribe. Whereas with me, it's just these overlapping circles of tribes. And I'm kind of like, that's cool with me. I want to bring back to the top. So reframing of conversations to what would the absence of poverty look like? What would the opposite of loneliness be, et cetera? But what comes next after what comes next? There's a huge conversation not to be had today about, you know, looking beyond this flexible working thing to what will that do? Because it's a short-term thing, thinking that, oh, well, you know, I can get a better paid job and stay in a low-cost jurisdiction, because now we go back to globalization, because that will change things. But there are positives and negatives if we look at that flexibility. But the one that's really been hitting me lately, talking to people, and this is the sixth country I've spoken with today, so I'm always talking to people globally. The realization is beginning to creep in with countries such as the UK, who are effectively pursuing a herd immunity strategy at this point. They've just taken all the restrictions off and going, Delta variant, people are going to get it.
Yeah.
You know, I've got family members in the 70s and 80s who've got
COVID. The scary thing is actually seems to be working, which is the other.
Well, yeah, I mean, but this is the thing. I've got a family member in the 70s and one in the 80s who've actually had COVID recently, and they felt rough, but were okay. Right. So we're now moving from pandemic to endemic.
Yes.
And it's very, very hard to say for your grandkids, my kids, their life is going to be one in a pandemic world.
Yes.
And it will likely never go away.
Absolutely.
And that's going to create mental health issues hugely. Now, if you're born into that now, if you're under 10 years old, say, you've never experienced.
Well, my grandkids are living this way.
But this is their life. But for the rest of humanity, we've lost something. There is a loss of freedom of operation and not having to think about interacting with people. Since the UK took away their restrictions on all social stuff 3 weeks ago, right? There was a survey done last week which said that 50% of the population have reduced their social activity since then. Not increased it, reduced it.
Yeah.
Because of the amount of Delta variant around. And they just go, I haven't had COVID yet. I don't want to get it. So that's what comes next after what comes next. And at a societal level, and then what impact does that have on business leadership, community, how we run things, what do we do? And I do think one of the positives is that we won't go back to, except in certain kinds of jobs and sectors, we won't go back to the 9 to 5, 5 days in the office.
Yeah, what's interesting, I mean, there's a bunch of, you know, everything has second, third, and fourth orders of effects, right? And you don't always know. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's happening as a result of 35 and 40-year-olds not taking $15 an hour jobs is a teenager can actually go get a job anywhere now.
All right.
A 16 or 17-year-old, a junior or senior in high school can walk in and get a bus job. They can get a job anywhere now, and those jobs are actually being filled by teenagers. There was a long time here in our country that the 7 and 8 and $10 hour jobs were not being filled because teenagers wouldn't do them.
Well, there's the American, in translating from America to the UK, I used to say in America, they say that a bachelor's degree qualifies you to say, would you like fries with that?
Exactly. And so I don't know where that effect takes us, but one of the biggest complaints about most employers in the States is the people that show up at their doorstep never had a job before. They don't know how to act at work. They don't know how to do this. They don't know how to do that. So we actually have the benefit of now how long and will that be a trend? I don't know, but it's this thinking about what's the next order of effects. And so, some of this is totally predictable.
Mm-hmm.
Some of this, in healthcare, a year and a half ago in my neck of the woods, you could not get anybody to do telehealth.
Right.
Everybody wants to do telehealth now. And the competitors for doing telehealth are coming from Minneapolis and Cleveland into Rochester. I mean, so the system is being disrupted in ways that, and now devices that were not get to the market before are now in rings and toilet seats and all kinds of sensitive devices that are doing wristbands. I mean, it's like things that probably wouldn't have come to the market before, but are now monitoring people in a whole bunch of different ways. All of this is predictable. All of it was sitting there on the edges, but required it. And then the other thing that you reminded me of, you know, Tom Friedman wrote a wonderful book a few years back called Thank You for Being Late.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you remember when he posited, he said the speed and the pace of change was outpacing the ability of our socioeconomic systems to keep up with the speed and pace of change. And you highlighted anxiety and depression. I mean, we're basically a depressed society.
Mm-hmm.
And the form of depression is called anaclitic depression. And the depression is actually separation from things that are important to you. It could be a family. It can be so it's separation. Anxiety is what remains when you lose things. And so the response or over response to things you see in our society are all coming out of that anaclitic depression.
That's
the fear of separation.
And the reality of it.
Yes.
So yeah, this is very personal for me because you read my blogs, and I wrote a couple of days ago about having a cloudy day, about having a depressed day.
Yeah.
and I'm not sure I put it in the blog, but fundamentally it was allowing myself to remember that I've not seen my sons for 18 months because I'll be seeing them in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Right? And I didn't want to allow myself to feel that when there was no closure and no ending of the separation coming. But actually allowing that subconsciously had it rush at me. Yeah. Right.
And it's probably been lingering there in the background.
Well, it's not. Yeah. And the thing is, some of us are quite good at, I'm quite good at compartmentalizing, right? And just saying, I can't control it. So let me not think, overthink it or whatever. But that's a personal bit. But the broader sense is my friend Chris Van Der Kyle, another guest in the show, has a phrase about the fourth industrial revolution and technology leaps that he says, we're living in the fastest times we've ever lived in and the slowest we will ever live in.
Yes.
And that at a human level has massive impact. If you turn around to people and you give them a massive menu of employee perks and say, hey, you can work from home 3 days a week, 2 days a week. You can choose to work in a different structure. You can take a pay structure. You can do this. And they go, some people are going, you know, particularly those who've worked in industries with production and consistency in Rust Belt type cities like Rochester, a lot of people may have been working in the same job for 30 years and that may have stopped or they may change it and they go, hey, now you've got all this choice. And they're going, I like the stability. I don't deal with change very well, you know, and, yeah.
So before we sign off, though, one of the things I want to circle back to, if you don't mind, the antidote to anaclitic depression is what?
Well, if it's about being separated from things, what would you say the answer is?
Well, you just said the answer. It's connection.
Okay.
It's connection. And so one of the things, and you highlighted this earlier, the generation, the younger generation, one of the things they know in the study of separation anxiety and anaclitic depression and that sort of thing, one of the things that we know, if you take a young person or you took somebody in an orphanage and they did not have the care and the cuddling and the things of being that you need as an infant, people who don't have that in their youth will be disconnected forever. They never get beyond the anaclitic depression of those times.
And I'll pause on that because
that's the what happens after what comes next.
And that's savage because
yes,
in British psychology, there were some ghastly experiments done in the 50s to the point where I won't even name the guy who did it.
Yes.
And it created a concept that is standard practice and accurate practice in psychology called attachment theory.
Yes.
And they literally, if you can watch the black and white YouTube videos of it, they literally tore toddlers away from their parent or their mother and saw how they responded. And over time, some of them just became detached. And
they cannot have relationships in any firm or form that you and I would consider to be relationship. Are we creating a whole society of that next generation? And so again, this is one of those questions that kind of gets swept under the rug. Slater way back in the 70s also coined the thing. He said, Americans are great at this. He called it the toilet assumption. He said, Americans are really great. We think we flush things down the toilet and they go away forever. And so, this is the kind of conversation we should be having about that and making sure we're establishing the kind of connections with and through each other and between each other and not disconnections. We have a whole society that's working in the opposite direction.
So if I was to summarize this, then I'll let you have the last, I'll always ask you the last word. The absence of poverty beyond basic needs, food, shelter, safety, is a connected society.
Yeah. Wow. Well, connection to others, connection to the same thing, connection. I mean, what's happening here in the States, the mythology that we all kind of bought into has been exploded in a whole variety. Not that it was, it might have been true or not true, doesn't matter. People believed that it was true.
Hmm.
Or enough of the people believed that it's true that we weren't questioning it. And it's all been, the myths have all been taken away from people, and people's reaction and overreaction to that is extraordinary. It's emotional. You can't talk people out of their position with facts.
Yeah. We've become disconnected in many ways.
And because it's so emotionally ingrained and it's all out of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and facts get attached to the fears.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't change, it's not just one fact that get attached to the fear. It's hundreds of facts get attached to the fear, and they keep reinforcing each other. The confirmation bias and all that you see playing out every minute of every day. And so that's why reframing becomes so, so crucial, because we've got to find the common ground of the connection.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, great companies and the companies that you work for, the companies that you work with and the people you work with, yeah. The greatest gift you are giving to them yeah. is a regrounding of that connection.
That's a very kind thing to say about the work. And in 2.5 hours time, midday Pacific, I'll be doing that with a leadership team that is looking to get very clear on who they are, what their culture is, and what they want to bring to the world.
Right.
The biggest thing we're doing is taking the individuals and patiently over a long period of time, a call every week, because we're doing it all virtually,
right.
is having them really connect to themselves and each other.
Right. What ground can we stand on together?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll use that line, Bruce. We've gone way over time.
That's always true. It's always true.
This is the key thing for me that I've really come to discover now. I'm well over 50 conversations in, is really this is about having people see inside conversations I have with some quite amazing people in the various connections I have. And one of these days you and I will meet in person, but I always feel exceptionally connected to you whenever we talk. One of the cool things is we exchange emails sometimes. You go, hey, I thought of you and have a look at this, because you're about the most well and diversely read person I've ever met. So, I just wanted to thank you for being Bruce and, for sharing half an hour of yourself with others who will see and listen to this over time. So.
And, if there's anybody out there that actually watches this and would like to continue the conversation, I'd be welcome to do that.
Also. And where do people find you, Bruce? Where's the best place to find you?
Email is best, bruceP@beyondteal.com.
bruceP@beyondteal.com. And they can look up beyondteal.com. Okay.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great.
Go well. Be well. Take care of yourself. And have fun going back home.
I will.